Welcome to Access Utah. Tom Williams here. Just wanted to let you know that this is a new interview, new-ish, because of some of the things we'll talk about. I just wanted to give you a heads up that we recorded this interview with Michael McLean in late April. A lot of flooding in New Zealand at that time. Still, unfortunately, some flooding, but not as bad as it was. Anyway, here's my interview recorded in late April with Michael McLean. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For thousands of years, Great Salt Lake has played a surprisingly central role in the lives of humans and animals throughout the American West and across entire continents. A new book is out. It's called The Once and Future Lake. It brings together nature writers, scientists, and storytellers to reveal the beauty of this complex ecosystem, to proclaim a future where the Great Salt Lake will once again thrive, as long as we act before it's too late. Through essays, story, and poetry, these writers show how intertwined the lake's fate is with our own, and that restoring, rewilding Great Salt Lake is possible, practical, ambitious, and essential. We're going to talk on this hour with the volume's editor, Michael McLean, who's author of the chapbooks Fume and Trace Elements. He's founding editor of the journal Salt Front, a review editor for Sugar House Review, and a poetry editor for Dark Mountain. His work has appeared in numerous journals and anthologies, including Western Humanities Review, Colorado Review, Laurel Review, Interim, Utah Historical Quarterly, South Dakota Review. He recently earned a PhD from Victoria University's International Institute of Modern Letters. He's from Salt Lake City, lives in New Zealand. That's where we reach him now. Michael McLean, I guess you're in New Zealand because of your program, school, PhD program?
That's correct. Yeah, I moved down in 2019 to do the PhD program at the IIML at Victoria. Finished that up about a year and a half ago. In the meantime, my wife and I had purchased a small bar and restaurant in Martinborough, which is out in wine country in the Wairarapa, just over the Remataka Range from Wellington.
Yeah, well, before we jump into the book here, just tell me a little bit about life in New Zealand. It's exotic to me and like some of our listeners.
It's beautiful. It's an incredibly beautiful country. Kiwis are lovely. Yeah, it is. We have very much enjoyed the nearly 6.5-7 years that we've been down here. It's just, it's safe. Most of the time it's calm. Right now it is very, very, very wet. Mm-hmm. So we are getting just deluged with rainstorms. What people would probably recognize as an atmospheric river is passing over us for what seems like the 100th time this year.
You do mention, and I was reading a blog post also in your introduction to this volume, it's a surreal feeling, a desert guy, right, coming, you raised in essentially in the desert, going to now what you call a waterlogged place.
Yeah, we, particularly the last couple of years, we have, we've seen a couple of really severe cyclones, I mentioned the atmospheric rivers. We're seeing them come through much more often now. It's a place where people are always close to the water. The vast majority of the people in New Zealand live on or very near the coast. And it's a green and very watery place. But it is really come into kind of an acute focus here in the last, particularly in the last week. I mean, the flooding, as I mentioned to you when we were chatting a little bit earlier, this is the worst flooding we've seen in this area since 1976. So this is really I'm sitting here this morning trying to wrap my head around drought and flooding at once, and it is surreal.
Hmm. So when Tory House reached out to you with this project, were you in New Zealand? You might wonder, well, why are they asking a guy in New Zealand to put together this book?
I was living in New Zealand at that point. Yeah. I had been here. I'd been out of Utah for almost 3 years at that point. And I had been kind of monitoring what had been happening back with lake levels and the condition of the lake. Certainly something I was interested in. Wasn't expecting that invite. It was a surprise. Not because I I don't have the interest or the qualifications to do the book, but just because I had been gone for a while. So it did come as a surprise.
Of course, that could be an advantage, too, at a kind of at a remove, a different perspective, putting together this volume.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
In introduction to the book, the book, again, is The Once and Future Lake, Stories from the Great Salt Lake. The editor, Michael McLean, is with us. And the foreword, very appropriately, is by Terry Tempest Williams. We'll get into talking about refuge a little later. But you say it's easy to forget how bodies of water we belong to shape our way through the world. It's interesting. You've, you know, Great Salt Lake, of course, and then the Pacific Ocean surrounds you there in New Zealand.
Yep. Yep. Pacific on one side, Tasman Sea on the other. And as I'm experiencing this morning, it is very much shaping and eroding the world and the lives around us. We are... two of the roads out of town right now are closed because bridges have kind of washed away. So that is, very different from the Great Salt Lake, which, I mean, yeah, I grew up in the benches out near the mouth of Big Cottonwood Canyon. And, you know, from my parents' place growing up, we could see the lake. It was always kind of a ribbon, a glimmer out on the edge of the horizon. I knew about the lake effect, knew about how the storms functioned and how that, you know, affected not just the weather, but the economy in the city and jobs and all kinds of other things. It really was a force that we didn't always acknowledge as being at the forefront, but it kind of shapes everything in the city.
You're right. You do a little bit of history in the introduction. I want to have you take us through a little bit of that. Interesting. Sets kind of some context and background. You point out that Captain Stansbury, who was the first to do a kind of a full survey of the lake, he was not impressed. He was greatly disappointed, he wrote in his journal.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of kind words for Great Salt Lake. I think the kind of exoticism that he had been presented with from other people that had been there, it didn't bear out to him. And he saw a place that was, he perceived as being dead and desolate and, you know, inhospitable, which I think we still, you can see that in, there's one piece in the book by Claire Wallmanholm that touches on some Google reviews of the Great Salt Lake. And we still see that today with tourists who get there. You know, they go all this way to go out to this place and they are not necessarily impressed. I think Stansbury had a similar feeling.
Yeah.
Of course, he had gone through much more effort to get to the Great Salt Lake than most tourists today.
Mm-hmm. You point out, and I don't think I knew the full extent of this history. A certain point, there were hot springs, there were healing properties. People went to take the waters. Many more resorts than Saltaire. This was definitely a destination for quite a while.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. That was actually, I think that was in many ways my entry point to this history and to the ecology of the Great Salt Lake. This was when I was in the environmental humanities program at the University of Utah. My project dealt with Beck Street and Warm Springs in particular. And this was an incredibly important cultural and really spiritual history for the Great Salt Lake as well, because both Native American tribes and the Mormons used the springs for spiritual purposes, religious purposes, and also for leisure. At one point in time, there was a dedicated railroad line that went from Black Rock and Garfield Beach all the way around to Warm Springs, then up to Lagoon and to Beck's Hot Springs. And I mean, this was the whole coastline around and through the wetlands of the Great Salt Lake were very important to the city for leisure purposes. Most people know about Saltaire and the kind of big dance hall that was there, and it was, you know, the roller coasters and things. but there was much more infrastructure than that that was dedicated to leisure and to bathing and boating and that kind of thing.
In fact, you said Beck Springs. Is that where Beck Street came from?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
He was an entrepreneur. He created one of the first big soda companies, did sodas and sparkling waters and things, all kinds of healing tonics and that sort of thing. And he built an enormous resort out on the eastern shore there. Not far from where Warm Springs Plunge, the Warm Springs Plunge building is now, a little bit farther north. They had a racetrack. They had, you could actually take a boat from a marina at the springs out through a little canal that they had built directly into the Great Salt Lake. Did all kinds of huge events and celebrations and parties out there. It was, it burned down, as all of these resorts did at one point or another. It burned down several times, and finally they, the family just decided they had had enough, and there wasn't enough interest in purchasing the property, and so it kind of fell by the wayside.
You write that this heyday was bright but brief. In the first half of the 20th century, it seemed Great Salt Lake was destined to shift from medical geography to forgotten geography, from the valley's heart to a kind of amputated limb. So why did that happen? Why the shift?
A lot of that had to do with the increase in mountain recreation. The views kind of shifted from water-based recreation to mountain-based, in particular skiing. This is when we start to see camping as kind of a family leisure activity really increase exponentially. Part of this had to do with economics because the kind of big long family vacation was not as, that was harder to do during the war period, in particular World War II period. Tires were expensive, gasoline was expensive, all these other things. So people were trying to stay closer by. And so the tourists coming from afar to these hot springs resorts, they weren't showing up. The locals weren't enough to sustain them economically. People were just staying closer to home because of the prices of things. But ultimately, it was skiing and mountain recreation that changed that. And in a lot of ways, that was very beneficial for the industries that were starting to spring up around the lake at that point. We see all kinds of industry tied to defense contractors and the military industrial complex spring up around the Great Salt Lake at this point. And with people's eyes turning to the mountains instead, that was very beneficial for them. It made it easier to kind of make people forget about the lake and to proceed with, the ventures that they had set up there to do.
Seems like that posture toward the lake persisted for quite a while. That's the posture that I'm familiar with. We kind of are back to the lake, right? It's there, but we're not paying as much attention to it.
I would agree. I mean, that was kind of the position that I grew up with as well. I don't think it was accidental. I think in some ways that was often fostered by people who had economic interests and, industrial ventures around the lake. I think some of that was just kind of passive negligence on the part of a lot of us in the valley, but I think some of that notion was fostered as well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Gertrude Stein wrote about Great Salt Lake in her own inimitable way. I just want to quote this letter to Alice Toklas. There is the land which nobody can see because there is the sea, and yet there is the land in America. There is the land, Salt Lake land, where there is no sea. Sounds very Gertrude Stein.
I love that passage.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
She was out on this tour of America doing readings all over the place, and And she passed through the Great Basin and just absolutely fell in love with the whole area. And there isn't a lot of writing about it, but there's just these little snippets, including what what she sent back to the Toklas. And it's just one of my favorite Stein lines. I love that passage.
You quote Dale Morgan. He did many histories, of course. Published The Great Salt Lake in 1949. Just one quote here. It's the name itself, he says, has an aura of the strange and mysterious, but it resists those who would know it. He goes on to say that Great Salt Lake is an ironical joke of nature, water that is itself more desert than a desert.
I wish. I think Morgan's book is now back in print. I think University of Utah Press has brought it back into print. It was out of print for many, many years, and I never understood why. It's such an important book about the lake, and as interest continued to grow, it just was never reprinted. And I never understood that because he has such a love of the place and such an appreciation of its kind of eccentricities and contradictions. It's a fabulous book. Yeah.
You note that it was Dale Morgan, who others probably have as well, but he dropped the. I know
Yes.
when the whole fame of the lake, the drought and the 19 the 2022 report, and media, including UPR, started getting involved. There's a whole debate over, is it the Great Salt Lake or is it Great Salt Lake? He dropped the, and there's sort of notions of agency here, you write.
Yeah, I think I am. He didn't write a great deal about this notion, but I think he understood the kind of greater ecology of the lake, the massive ecosystem that it represented, and was willing to grant it a certain amount of agency by dropping that article. And this is something that comes up much later with Terry Tempest Williams writing and other writers as well. And it's something we talked a lot about with this book, and how to we in the end we left it up to the authors to kind of choose whether or not to do that, and didn't go with one consistent way of naming the lake. More and more, as more time goes on and I spend more time in this topic, I'm with Morgan and with Williams on this one. I try to remember to lose the and grant it that agency. And I mean, part of that may be living down here in New Zealand, where the Kiwis really set the precedent for this kind of personhood, for net for kind of large ecological entities. Te Odorowera Forest, a few hours north of me here, was granted personhood about a decade ago. The Whanganui River was also kind of set the precedent for granting a body of water personhood. So this is something that's it's on my mind a lot. So I'm glad you touched on that. Thank you.
You also write, speaking of the Maori people, you write about, for them, as I guess probably many indigenous peoples, it's relationships. And they introduce themselves in relationship to the land. And you write that using that construct, you say, my mountain is Olympus, my lake is Great Salt Lake.
Yeah. I mean, I spent the vast majority of my life in the Salt Lake Valley, right at the foot of the Wasatch, and we don't have there's not a lot of water, so the Great Salt Lake was the natural pick. But as I mentioned earlier, it shaped so much of life in the valley that that relationship it's inextricable at this point. It is. Yeah, the Wasatch Mountains and the Great Salt Lake are, it's a another kind of parents, I guess, when you grow up there.
I guess some would say, and some of the writers in this volume say as well, that that is our problem right now, right? With many of us don't have a relationship to the lake. We don't view it that way. It's a resource, but we don't have a relationship.
And this is something. There were a couple of people who contributed to the book that I was really happy to see those pieces come in, because they were people who had actually, they lived in Salt Lake for a number of years and never went to the lake. And I think that perspective was really crucial to have, because I don't think that they're not a small minority. I think lots and lots of people either grow up in Salt Lake or live nearby and never really visit the lake, never spend any time out there. And that is very much part of the problem with the perception of Great Salt Lake at this point. You have to spend time there to understand that it's inhospitable to humans, but it makes life in the city possible at the same time. That's one of its many contradictions. It is a harsh environment for us to be in long term, you know, at the lake, at Great Salt Lake itself. But without it, life in the valley and the greater, you know, kind of Salt Lake metro area becomes very, very difficult.
Back very briefly on personhood for the lake, Brooke Williams, Terry's husband, cantos for the Great Salt Lake. I noticed several of those verses, they're in bold. And he says, Great Salt Lake deserves legal personhood. Repeats that about four times in that poem.
Yes. And I, you know, Brooke and Terry have been very much at the forefront of that push, and, you know, spreading the word that personhood, you know, the precedent is out there. This is something that we can potentially achieve. But it takes, you know, kind of disavowing ourselves of these previous perceptions of the place and what role it plays in our lives.
Now, you talk specifically about Terry Tempest Williams and refuge. How important is refuge to, I guess, literature about the lake?
It's hugely important. It's crucial to, you know, an entire generation, going into two generations now of writers and some, you know, also scientists and journalists. Appreciation of and understanding of the lake and how the kind of crises and issues facing it run parallel to those that we face in our own lives due to other, you know, whether climate change or the causes of cancer clusters that Terry is discussing in Refuge. That book changed people's perceptions in so many ways. And it's been a slow burn as well. Like that book, it keeps coming up and it bubbles up again and again and again. And part of that is from, you know, teachers in universities and other settings like that using the book repeatedly. But just, I think Salt Lake has so many people moving to it from outside of Utah. And we see this in Sarah Fox's essay. You know, she moves to Logan to do graduate school. And the first thing she does is start looking for books that are about this new place that she's in. And Refuge is probably probably the most famous book to come out of Utah by a Utah author. And so, of course, she comes to Refuge. And, I think we see that again and again with people who move to Utah. And it's one of the first kind of pieces about Utah they discover. And it's hugely important to fostering a relationship with the lake.
You also write, we probably shouldn't neglect this, the Mormons, right? The Latter-day Saints who came and kind of this strange geography. And then they imprinted biblical names, right?
Yep.
And an ethos on the land.
Yeah. And this was a clever bit of bonding and marketing done by Brigham Young and others, because they, you know, he understood that giving people, these people in this far-flung place, living a kind of hardscrabble life initially, ways to kind of bind them together and give them a sense of purpose was very important. And so kind of comparing them to these biblical settings and biblical peoples, that would help foster that kind of unity. But also, Young was savvy enough to understand that economically, the settlement could not survive without contact with the outside world. And when the springs, when it became clear that the springs could be a really important point of leisure, particularly for people coming between, you know, the eastern states and California and other places during the gold rush and other time periods of settlement, he understood that that kind of that exoticism that we've talked about a couple of times could help foster tourism to this place and help bring in some money and help bring in the railroad and keep the economy of his settlement going. And so they worked with the railroads in particular to really foster these ideas of, you know, the Dead Sea and the Jordan River. And, you know, they didn't even downplay the kind of Brigham Young being the kind of overseer of his own Turkish harem kind of thing. But, you know, that shows up in these railroad tourism books, and, you know, all of this gets played up, and, you know, he never tried to downplay it. He knew it was useful for the economy.
You're right. I'm just going to read the most of a paragraph here. We know how these water stories end. We can only be exceptional in our capacity for both empathy and change. Our myths cannot save us this time. The only persecution here we brought upon ourselves. We have a brief window to shift this trajectory. It's imperative we are honest about the quality of sacrifice and changes necessary to achieve it. You want to say some groups are rising to the challenge. So I want to, action obviously, and by all of us, right, is needed. I wonder what the role of art, literature, but, you know, the role of a book like this is, as you see it in this effort.
And this is something we talked a lot about in kind of coming up with a framework for this book, because it came in the wake of Ben Abbott and the kind of interagency report that he released back in, I believe it was 2002 or 2022, excuse me. And it was an ominous report, and it's not necessarily easy to convey those numbers to the average person. It's abstract. And Ben actually did a very good job of making those things, as the threats that those numbers represent, as concrete as possible, Ben and other people involved. But still, we wanted something that was coming from more of an artist's perspective on this book, because it's, well, I make that assertion of myths cannot save us. I'm more referring to myths around the inevitability of progress and technology, and, you know, let's just throw data centers out there. These are the inevitability of that. We can resist that, and you know, having a personal relationship with these places, and illustrating those relationships through art helps bring people onto the side that, you know, we need to look at these issues. We need to staunch some of the diversion that's happening. We need to address ways to deal with the drought and, you know, these new uses of water that are being put into play that are going to make life in the valley very, very hard going forward. We need to have some hard conversations about how many people can be there and how much water we can use, and, you know, what the tipping point is here.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest is Michael McLean. He's the editor of a new volume out from Torrey House Press. It's called The Once and Future Lake, Stories for the Great Salt Lake. We'll have more following a brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. A new book's out from Torrey House Press called The Once and Future Lake, Stories for Great Salt Lake. And it's edited by Michael McLean, and he is my guest for the hour. Joining me from New Zealand, very wet New Zealand. By the way, I don't know, you encounter people, maybe they say, where are you from? I'm from the Great Basin Desert. What's their reaction?
I get kind of one of three reactions when I say I'm from Utah. Either they say, oh, are you a polygamist? Which, you know, that's the oldest one in the book. I'm used to that by now. Anywhere I travel, I get that. Or two, they say, oh, you must be a skier. Because the vast majority of people I talk to here, they're going to Salt Lake City to ski. Or the third thing is they bring up the national parks, which is more reassuring. Like, that's really glad to hear that so many people here are making the trip out there to go to the national parks. So that's nice. But yeah, the polygamous question is by far the most popular one.
Yeah, that's very enduring, I guess, that one. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe give me an overview, list off a few more of the authors. We'll get to a few of these and have you read some passages as we go along. We mentioned Terry Tempest Williams wrote the foreword. We mentioned Brooke Williams. You mentioned a few others. Tell me a few more of the authors.
Yeah, I mean, we have the current poet laureate, Lisa Bickmore, is in the book. The former poet laureate, Paisley Rectal, is also included. Some work that ties in with her book, West, which I think you've had her on to talk about.
I believe so, yeah.
We have a whole slew of poets from around Utah in the book. Joel Long is in there, Danielle Dabrowski from Cedar City, Adam Davis, who's now living in California but grew up in Salt Lake City. We went to Brighton High School together. We've got fiction writer Charles Waugh, who has a great piece of flash fiction in there. Alyssa Quinn, who was a PhD graduate from the University of Utah's Creative Writing Program. A chapter from their novel in the book that I love. Let's see, we've got Terry Harmon, who has some fantastic work about the Jordan River corridor. She's doing really, really important work dealing with that corridor between Utah Lake and Great Salt Lake. And Nan Seymour, who has done tireless work for Great Salt Lake, activism of all sorts, from she did a creative writing anthology about the lake herself that I think was important with Salt Lake Community College, if I remember correctly. We've got a lovely intro from Friends of the Great Salt Lake, who of course have been, we owe so much to the work that they do. During all these many years when nobody was talking enough about the lake, they were talking a lot about the lake and really pushing for protections for the wetlands, for Great Salt Lake itself, for bird populations. I mean, they've just been relentless in their work. And so we owe a lot to them. So we were happy to have them provide their intro as well.
Let's turn to your piece of the book. Here's the title. It was as though for a time I didn't exist. Great Salt Lake and Carnival of Souls. Let me have you read a couple of paragraphs from your piece.
All right. Yeah, this is the first few paragraphs of the essay. Herc Harvey made just one feature film in his long career. 1962's Carnival of Souls. The project was born when Harvey, on his way home to Kansas from Los Angeles, pulled off the highway to wander the ruins of the Saltaire Resort. By then, Saltaire was landlocked, looming over the dried bed of Great Salt Lake while the waters had receded far into the distance amid a long drought. He sensed the place as haunted by its past as by its uncertain future. What grew from that short encounter was the story of a woman named Mary Henry, who was likewise haunted, caught in limbo between past trauma and a community either indifferent to her plight or eager to exploit it. So much of Mary is liminal, caught between cities, jobs, navigating both the labyrinth of leering men and her new home and the gothic ruins of Saltaire, which call irresistibly to her despite the ghouls lurking beneath its boardwalks. In many interpretations, Mary is caught in the final seconds between life and death, time and consciousness expanding and contracting in ways that leave her impossibly disoriented. The last we see of Mary's life is her footprints angling out from the resort towards the shallows of Great Salt Lake. Suddenly she is gone, dilute, evaporative, a precipitate spun out of solution. I wanted to write a straightforward essay on the Great Salt Lake, to parallel it with an underappreciated film, to tell a story in a nice, neat arc, not unlike each day I shared space with her, the sun catching the glint of water in the morning and setting the shallow western horizon between the Ochres and Antelope Island ablaze every evening. But life on the periphery of Great Salt Lake is episodic. I think this is true for many who live nearby. The mountains tower over us, the cityscape envelops us in a sea of concrete and facade. Great Salt Lake dwarfs the city. It lays low, a long shadow. Everywhere waters are diverted, rerouted, put in culverts, both literal and figurative. Daylighting them takes effort or sensory intrusion. 1,000 birds alighting at once, a lake effect snowstorm, the smell of die-off, the specular reflection of mountains and salt mirrors as you speed from one state to another at 120 miles per hour. We stare or listen or breathe a little more slowly. What feels intrusion is a momentary integration, a memory, synesthetic and nameless. In the film's opening moments, Mary inexplicably walks away from what should have been a watery grave in a Kansas river. The world shifts around, or perhaps within her, as she finds herself increasingly alienated from her community, precipitating a sudden move to Salt Lake City to take a job as a church organist. She experiences ghostly hallucinations and dissociative events in which the world carries on around her, though others are incapable of hearing or seeing her, and she incapable of hearing them. These events are cued for the audience by a wavering or rippling in the shot, as if mirage or stifling heat.
Yeah, that's a Carnival of Souls. You write that Herc Harvey, this is the early 60s.
Yeah, 62,
yeah.
I believe. Yeah, 62.
And at that point, Saltaire is no longer in use, and it's kind of dilapidated, but it's still there.
Yeah, it was derelict at that point. And it was kind of funny because during filming, I think he paid whoever was kind of the custodian of it at that point. He paid them something like $50 to use it for filming. And it had been unused for so long that when he started filming the night sequences there, the communities of, you know, Tooele and Stansbury out, or Grantsville out there, could see the lights on out at the park, and people were really unsettled by it. They called the police. You know, the police showed up numerous times to make sure that everything was okay. It was a place that had really kind of been forgotten until suddenly the lights went back on, and that really unsettled people.
What was, you know, the different interpretations of the film, of course, you have your own here, and you know, associating that with the lake. What did Herc Harvey want to accomplish here with his film, do you think?
It's interesting because it kind of gets, this movie often gets lumped in with kind of the B-movie craze of the 60s and early 70s. And he was ahead of his time a bit. I mean, in many ways, this Carnival of Souls is very much a feminist film. This is, Mary Henry is navigating, as I note early on in this essay, just this, it's a constant kind of leering from particularly the men around her. And not just necessarily kind of a sexual gaze, but just very spiteful all around. And she's a woman alone in the world, taking on a job in a new place. And, you know, Harvey knew very little about Salt Lake City. The way Salt Lake City is presented in the film is he gets some things right. The insularity of the city, particularly at that point of time, you know, it was a very different place in the late 50s, early 60s than it is now. And so the insularity, he gets it, but like, you know, she stays at a boarding house where the landlady's serving coffee and other things, and there's bars all over the place near her, and it doesn't quite feel like Salt Lake City in moments. Mm-hmm. But He was still very ahead of his time and kind of examining this gaze that she experiences everywhere around her, and this idea of nobody's really listening to her, nobody is accepting that she's in trouble. They just all kind of dismiss it or literally cannot hear it. And so he was definitely exploring that a bit, but ultimately he was. He talks about that experience standing by the shores of that place and just trying to imagine how those ruins got to be the way they were, how Saltaire became that way, and how a person can kind of get forgotten, or a place can get forgotten and dismissed. And so he tells that through Mary's eyes.
Yeah, it's worth going back and taking a look at that the film again. I want to have you read the poem by Alex Caldiero, who we unfortunately just lost not too long ago here.
Yes.
And you have a poem of his included in the anthology.
Yeah, I was looking forward to Alex is an old friend, and we've been trying to make a reading together happen now for a few years, and I just never could quite make the travel arrangements work at a time that worked for both of us. And was really devastated when we lost him last month. And but there's it was amazing to see all the tributes coming out to Alex. And I know Torben Bernhard and Travis Lowe, who did a wonderful documentary about him, are kind of issuing a new cut of that documentary and doing some screenings around town and doing a lot to help celebrate him. And I am planning on turning Alex's poem, Salt, into a broadside, in collaboration with some other people, and that's going to be kind of our tribute to Alex, who we miss deeply. Okay. Alex, I'm going to try and do this justice.
You'll put on the sinosopher, as he would, I guess. Yeah,
I am
yes.
not the sinosopher he was. Salt. Salt. The title alone makes this a poem. Body never found is ecologically correct. The shelf life of a sigh in early summer air. A snake across my path would mean something. So much depends on nothing. Stones sleep with eyes open. Can't wait to speak with no punctuations. One day a lie began to believe itself. The rest is history. A glass of water. You thirst. You drink. I plagiarize my own life. I write my pain and words have no feeling. I write my pain and words have no feeling. As you finger your hand, as you handle the pen, as you pen your name, as you name your poison, as you poison your mind, as you mind your thought, as you thought you would. Poem, breath, poem, breathe. Poem breathes poem.
So Alex Caldiero's poem called Salt. It's included in this anthology. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. And the book is called The Once and Future Lake, Stories for Great Salt Lake. The editor is Michael McLean. He's with us for the hour. Let's take another brief break. Come back with a final segment. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about a new anthology. It's called The Once and Future Lake, Stories for Great Salt Lakes, out from Torrey House Press. The editor is Michael McLean, who joins us from New Zealand, where he lives now. I want to, I guess, the end of the program, have you read the final poem by the poet laureate Lisa Bickmore. Any other piece stands out to you at this point you'd like to talk about briefly?
Yeah, I really hope people take a really good look at Sarah May's poems. We have three different sections from a much longer poem that she's published as a chapbook. They're hard poems. They're raw. They're difficult. They hopefully will make people uneasy. They deal with exploitation of various kinds, but she ties it all back to the lake in really beautiful ways. And I hope people, I really wanted to include as much of of her chapbook as I could. And I hope people spend time with those three poems.
Well, we're down to just a few minutes left. We'll have you read the final poem. This is the current Utah Poet Laureate, Lisa Bickmore.
Sorry, as I mentioned earlier, I haven't received the hard copy of the book yet because I live so very far away. So I'm navigating a PDF at the moment. Give me just a moment. One of the joys of being in New Zealand is things that end up in the post take a long, long time to get.
It, literally the other side of the world, that's for sure. Yeah.
While I'm doing this, I do also want to say the last submission to come in, and I'm so happy that it did, was from Hannah Saltzman, who is a pediatrician and a mother herself. And her piece in here, it's just gorgeous and heartbreaking. And it's about Great Salt Lake and about her child from the point of view of both simultaneously a doctor and a mother. And it's remarkable. So I would, it's right towards the end of the book as well. And I would really recommend people spend a lot of time with that. It's one of my favorite pieces in the book. And I'm so glad that thanks to Joel Long for pointing Hannah our way, because it's one of my favorite pieces in here. Okay. Again, Lisa, I'll try and do this justice. This, no pressure. Inhuman time. Not dimensional and not in my mind spacious. For so long, the lake was a blank with only a book full of floating Mormons to fill it. Meaning it was a lacuna, news to me, its population of flies and microfauna. Although a man I knew once had a boat, was a brine shrimp fisherman who fancied himself a captain, fancied himself rough and ready, and more than that, raised Mormon, but an emphatic renouncer. A good captain always shares the catch with his crew, he told me, as if naming a foundational ethic of the lake. The lake was fuller than I think, perhaps, stretching our capacity for understanding. For a century or more, enough of us took water as a right, refusing to know that water taken as a right eventually punishes. In the last 3 years, we've gone twice, and each time it felt more like a dream, pink and foamy at the recessive shore, from which my husband picked up armfuls of foam, shore bloom, knee-high, barely wet, but surely salty. Years before, along the eastern shore of another inland sea, the Salton, its diffuse horizons miraging as we stopped to look across. The towns we drove through, someone's idea of future resorts ending in hardpan failure. And still someone's lived there, somewhere besides in the houses taken down to the studs. Abandon hope, all ye who enter, scrawled in spray paint by a literalist on one wall, buried alive on another. At the south end, a wild bird refuge at dusk, numberless water birds aloft, the sun burning to its conclusion. At that shore, we saw dead birds too, and dead fish, despite its refuge, the sea shrinking and toxic. I don't want to say harbinger. When we went to the Salt Lake the first time, of course, we went to see the jetty. As we drove, the signs, both indicated and confused, it glittered, all of it. A dead, long-necked bird curved into a half-heart, diamantine and salt. Is this a story that will help? The first time was 3 weeks before my father died, the second 3 months after my sister. The spiral like a tattoo, a spiral like time unfurling, not geologic time, because it is human scale, made by a man, with earth movers and ideas. Human scale, and therefore containing the seed of loss, longer than a single life, though intended to be that, intended to be to undo very slowly, be undone only by erosion, by waves and time itself. And in that, like the lake, also made by the earth moving, by ancient waters' changes. The next time I am there, I want to be there when it rains, to watch snow melt into salt. I want to mark. No further anniversaries. I want to witness water having its own way.
That's Inhuman Time, poem by Lisa Bickmore. That's the poem that ends this anthology. It's a bit of a note of hope there. I guess that's why you wanted it at the end.
Absolutely. And, you know, despite all the difficult issues in this book, there is a lot of hope here. None of us have given up on Great Salt Lake. We're facing these issues head on.
Good place to end the conversation here. The book is The Once and Future Lake, Stories for Great Salt Lake. The editor is Michael McLean, who's joined us for the hour. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.